think you could start. I think you
can start. They'll check it, doctor. They'll check. Dr. Stanley Plotkin, developer of the rubella vaccine, has claimed that society as we know it today has been made possible by three developments: clean water, antibiotics, and vaccines. And although I can't think of any downside to clean water, probably all of us in this room can imagine that there are some issues having to do with antibiotics and vaccines, whether unintended consequences, whether influences on lifestyle choices, halachic, ethical, economic issues. Today's panel will touch on many of these and maybe even some I haven't mentioned. But before I introduce our panelists, I want to share with you a few vignettes from my own encounters with vaccinations. I grew up in LA, California, the land of sun and surf, where everybody seems to be an outstanding swimmer, and I am not. So why not, you might ask? Well, one of the obvious reasons is that I'm not very athletic and not very well coordinated. That's not really the main issue, and certainly doesn't relate to our session this afternoon. When I was growing up, the polio vaccines were first under development, the Salk and the Safety vaccines. And the polio virus grows in the digestive tract before it makes its way to the nervous system to cause paralysis. Because of its growth in the digestive tract, there was a very great possibility that one could contract polio from contaminated water, swimming water. Now, this was before the days of affluence. My parents didn't have a private pool, and we somehow didn't seem to know anyone with a private pool. So my parents were opposed to my swimming in a public swimming pool, and therefore I didn't get swimming lessons. Now, I must tell you that I didn't beg them, cajole them, ask them to please give me those lessons, because one view of people struck by polio who are living in an iron lung, and those of you young in the audience have no idea what it is, a kind of a cylindrical device that was an early type of respirator using vacuums to help people breathe who couldn't breathe because they were stricken by polio, only their heads extended out. A terrible, terrible way to have to survive until one could regain some muscle control. So I wasn't interested in swimming. Now, you'd think that this is all very positive, the development of polio vaccine, but there was a dark side to that as well, because in the early stages when there was clinical testing, there were children who were tested as part of the clinical trials without informed consent. Children who were disabled, developmentally disabled, living in the Letchworth Village Hospital up in Rockland County, which has since been closed. So that was the dark side of the development of vaccine. If we fast forward to the year 2009, that was the year when we had the great swine flu pandemic. And initially, there wasn't sufficient vaccine for everybody to be vaccinated. So the CDC issued kind of guidelines that would help health practitioners know how to distribute the limited resources. And they said, and I quote, "The virus does not seem to affect older adults." There are a lot of weasel words in there, "does not seem to affect." But with that little bit of information, older adults, myself included, were not eligible to receive the vaccine. Now here at YU, we did a massive campaign to inoculate our students, and we were very successful, Baruch Hashem. We kept in operation, and we had very few students who came down with swine flu. I, on the other hand, did come down with the swine flu. But it wasn't just that simple as a person deprived of the resource, because before I contracted swine flu, there really were enough vaccine available for me to get the shot. But I never returned to the health office to get it. So in a sense, I had chosen, maybe not actively, but passively, not to receive the inoculation. Now you'd say, okay, so I was the only sufferer, I got sick. But in a sense, it wasn't only about me, because I, in turn, could have communicated this disease to someone else. So what is the responsibility of the individual to be concerned about herd inoculation, about everybody being inoculated? Today, there are other issues that are coming to the fore. There's some movement afoot to talk about inoculating children as a preemptive strike against anthrax in case there's a terrorist attack with anthrax. And this is something that we never thought about before, using children as a kind of vehicle to protect us against terrorism. So there are a lot of issues having to do with vaccination. Dr. Plotkin, I think, is correct. Vaccines are almost a miraculous thing in our lives, but they do have an impact on life choices, on unintended consequences, on ethical, moral, halachic questions. And the panel we have today is extraordinary and able to answer many of those. I'm going to introduce them in the order in which they'll speak. Rabbi Dr. Moshe Tendler is the Rabbi Isaac and Bella Tendler Professor of Jewish Medical Ethics and a professor of biology, as well as a Rosh Yeshiva in the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary at Yeshiva University. Rabbi Tendler is a leading expert on medical ethics as it pertains to Jewish law. He is the author of Practical Medical Halacha, a textbook of Jewish response to medical issues, Pardes Rimonim, a book about the halachot of Taharat HaMishpacha, and Care of the Critically Ill, Responsa of Rav Moshe Feinstein, Volume 1. He has written extensively on euthanasia, infertility, end-of-life issues, organ donation, and Brit Milah. Rabbi Tendler chairs the Bioethical Commission of the Rabbinical Council of America and the Medical Ethics Task Force of UJA Federation of Greater New York. He is currently the rabbi of the Community Synagogue of Muncie. And as an aside, he was my mentor, and a very good one, when I was a faculty member many years ago at Yeshiva College. Rabbi Dr. Aaron Glatt is the assistant rabbi at Congregation Anshei Chesed in Hewlett and at the Young Israel of Woodmere. After graduating as class valedictorian of Yeshiva College, Rabbi Dr. Glatt received his MD from Columbia University. He is a board certified in internal medicine and infectious diseases and the author of over 200 articles, book chapters, and abstract presentations. Rabbi Dr. Glatt is currently president and CEO of St. Joseph Hospital in Bethpage, New York, as well as professor and former associate dean at New York Medical College. Previously a professor at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where he innovated the course Faith in Medicine, Rabbi Dr. Glatt is a world-renowned and sought-after scholar in residence, lecturing on a wide variety of Jewish and medical topics. He has given a daily Daf Yomi Shiur for the last two decades and has authored the book Visiting the Sick and Women in the Talmud. Dr. Warren M. Siegel is the chairman of pediatrics and director of adolescent medicine at Coney Island Hospital in Brooklyn and is an associate professor of clinical pediatrics at the SUNY Health Science Center in Brooklyn. He is the founder and director of the Division of Adolescent Medicine at the Coney Island Hospital, at Maimonides Infants and Children's Hospital, and at Lutheran Medical Center. Additionally, Dr. Siegel received a certificate in bioethics and medical humanities from Cardozo School of Law of Yeshiva University. He has served as president of the Brooklyn Pediatric Society, the New York Society for Adolescent Medicine, and the New York State Chapter 2, District 2 of the American Academy of Pediatrics. He currently serves as AAP's vice chair. Dr. Siegel is a member of the AAP's Executive Committee for the Section on Adolescent Health and the National Committee on Adolescence. And now it is my privilege to introduce to you Rabbi Tendler.
Thank you, Dr. Bacon. We're up to here. Who's in charge here?
Which
is the forward button?
This one. Okay.
I will, as my role of biology teacher, introduce the medical aspects of vaccination. But really, what I'm looking for. Looking for is how to resolve a problem, or rather, a search for a magnificent vaccine, a vaccine against ignorance. Not so easy, because there aren't too many intelligent people looking for it. Most of the people looking for it are also ignorant. Just have to read the underlying words. Vaccine began with an observation, and some of you, I'm sure, studied it in high school biology, that cow maize, the wolf and suffering blisters, were immune to most smallpox. That cowpox virus gave them immunity to smallpox. That's already our interpretation. They knew it empirically, and then Dr. Jenner came to that conclusion that by inoculating people with cowpox, they may protect them from smallpox. Now, smallpox, you have to understand, was a greater killer than the Black Death. Many people believe that the Aztec civilization died because of smallpox. It wiped them out. There was no immunity to it. Most people who contracted it died. And Jenner then did this wonderful experiment, absolutely illegal against the halacha. On May 14th, this has a pointer also, maybe? Yeah. On May 14th, 1796, he did an experiment. Who gave him permission to do it? Nobody knows. He inoculated a boy with matter taken from the pustular count, from the pustule of someone who contracted the cowpox, and then inoculated him with smallpox and showed that he was able to survive. This led to, strangely enough, a powerful anti-vaccination movement all over the world. Why? No one understands. I'll comment on it a little bit further. Blown up for you here. The Tepelish Yisrael, the most prominent commentary on the Mishnayos, in the end of Mishnayos Yuma, makes reference to smallpox inoculation. And he says as follows, neither li, appears to me that it should be permissible. Heta lasos inkulatay, whatever it is, shall pokin. Afsha echod me elef, Meis HaLidei inoculation, HaKoponim She'im Yishavu Bo HaPokin HaTvim, if he gets the natural disease, HaSakona Krova Yosef, much more dangerous. Therefore, even though I think there's a danger in being inoculated, the danger is less than the disease itself. And therefore, he answered basically the question, should the religious Jewish community begin inoculation against smallpox? Because of the halacha, as also the sakein es atzmo, you cannot put yourself in danger. And here there was a special, unique aspect to this disease. It's a disease that wasn't there. It was prophylactic. It was to prevent a disease. The halacha was clear. If someone suffers from a disease, you can violate the Shabbos, you can eat non-kosher in order to cure the disease. But here we're dealing with prophylactic medicine, preventive medicine. Does preventive medicine have the same permissibility as illness itself? And you'll see that point is raised in the not too common references to it in halakhic literature. That's the real underlying cause of the dispute, whether yes or no. And it takes a form, interestingly, in halakha. And Tzitz Eliezer, one of the most prolific writers on medical halacha, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, comments on the smallpox vaccine in relation to Shabbos. And as you see, the issue of preventive versus actual illness is what's troubling everybody. He quotes first I guess what was the custom of the time. Our doctors may want to comment on it. It seems that early inoculations were done serially. An individual received the smallpox, a pustule formed. The doctor would then take some fluid from the pustule and inoculate the next patient and the next patient. And so it kept. Didn't have a vaccine company that provided them with it, so it was a serial thing. So the shaila is there, can you do so on Shabbos? What's the issue? The Gemara talks about an abscess on Shabbos, where it is permissible to open up an abscess on Shabbos. And the Gemara basically is that if it causes discomfort, it's okay to open it up on Shabbos, but you do so only, as you people know, some of you I'm sure have experienced, you have a little infection, it forms a boil, open up the boil, with a needle, it relieves the pressure, you feel more comfortable. But you cannot do a surgical procedure. Namely, you had to do, it was a big abscess, a doctor most likely would put in a drain, make sure it doesn't close. No, we don't do that on Shabbos, but to relieve the pressure, that's okay. The question is, what is this fellow who has this pustule on him, what is he going to be treated with? What is it going to do for him? And interestingly, and that's the point that I want to make, nobody took the effort to go see what a doctor does. They say once, the first opinion here is to prohibit it. Why? Because it's a maleches, it's a maleches Shabbos. Why is it a maleches Shabbos, a violation of the Shabbos? Because it's a maleches tikkun, is what a doctor does in order to produce a cure permanently. What they had in mind, I don't know, but the big question is, why couldn't they go to a doctor and see what the doctor does? Others argue and say, no, all he does is take out a little pus. That's not considered to be more than matis musa, the expression that the Gemara uses for opening up a boil. The last point there that he quotes, these are all quotes of Achonim and Shadat Shuvah, Shuvah Miyava, right? He says it's mutu, lahargiv, to do the inoculation on Shabbos. Why? Because he held that preventive medicine, where there's a danger of death, a smallpox was a fatal, is a fatal illness, therefore you can be mechal Shabbos to prevent an illness. So he allowed a granting that it is chil Shabbos. Granting it is, nevertheless, it's permissible. And then, there, look at the last paragraph. I'm not so sure if the doctor really has to cause any bleeding. I'm not so sure whether it's considered to be a maleches tikkun, right? Maybe he just has to take out a little pus. So what struck me on this machlokes, why didn't they clearly go to see a doctor? Why did they start up? Why did they guess what a doctor does? Didn't seem to be necessary to do so. And that is part of our problem. The problem of providing information in halacha without a full understanding of the medical background that's necessary. That applies to the laws of Nida, that applies to the laws of Shabbos, that applies to the practice of medicine on Shabbos or on Yom Tov. Unless you understand what the issue is, and that covers all our great discussions that we've had from Mitzitza that we heard this morning, Mitzitza prepared for Mila, to the issue of when you declare a patient dead. Information has to be assimilated by somebody. Maybe 5 minutes, I believe. Better check your clock. Here we have a wonderful case, Shiloh of Rubella, where the question here being posed is, can you give a woman a shot against rubella virus, because that will require her not to become pregnant for a minimum of 3 months, or danger to the child. Again, very strange thing. The conclusion that he comes to is not so terrible, even though it violates the halacha, namely the requirement of a couple to have as many children as they can. Nevertheless, since after she gives birth, the halacha doesn't allow them to cohabit for a period of time, it's not a bad idea to give her the injection at the time after she gives birth. Now, it so happens that at the time she gives birth, 3 months, the likelihood of her becoming pregnant within 3 months after giving birth is somewhat remote by those who understand the endocrinology involved, the gynecology involved. Nevertheless, this is the psark. Again, preventive, and here is preventive to the fetus, the way he understands it, not preventive to the mother. The most sorry, wrong button. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Got it?
Yeah.
All right. This is Rav Yitzchak Herzog Zatzal, the first chief rabbi of Israel, was asked two questions. The first, can a kibbutz build a protective fence against the Arabs on Shabbos? Second half of the question, right, had to do with our issue of inoculations, and he answers the decision against. I'm sorry, the decision to prevent attack from the Arabs. That's an imminent attack. It could happen any time, including Shabbos. Therefore, the danger is imminent. And therefore, you can build a fence on Shabbos. How about the question of inoculations? That is for the future. He said, however, since the disease is rampant, therefore he believes, even though, and he says it clearly, even though the disease is not here yet, the disease is only a threatened disease, which makes it not imminent. Nevertheless, he permits to be Mechal Shabbos, to get inoculation on Shabbos. What you have here is a development of understanding of what the disease is, how the disease spreads, and therefore Rav Herzog, being more familiar with the medical literature, his own background exposed him to it, he was able to reach the conclusion that it should be permissible. Here's just a quick rundown. 16 inoculations are supposed to be provided to a child before the age of 6 or so. You take a look at what they are. Right, some are vaccines against bacterial disease, some are vaccines against viral disease, and notice what here, what's caused us some of our troubles. And that is, you'll notice that this rotavirus one is not used in the first world countries. It's largely being used in the third world countries to prevent childhood diarrhea there. But if you look at those lists, you see it has there the annotation, these are live viruses. And that's what's caused fright Why? Because indeed, as you see, reversion to virulence is possible. And those who are anti-vaccination people have played this up greatly. They found that most likely it's true that in the early polio vaccine, there were significant cases of reversal to the live, namely that the inoculation causes disease. And that led, that fueled the fire against vaccinations. What led the battle recently is the mumps vaccine, which we'll talk about in a minute. Excuse me, there are extra slides here. Some already are prepared for class. Just for your interest, here, this is the discoverer, right? There, Blumberg, discovered the hepatitis vaccine. If you take a look at what I underlined, I born in New York City. Blumberg's early schooling was at the Orthodox Yeshiva of Flatbush, which perhaps accounted for a scholarly and deliberative Talmudic approach to problem and science. Okay, that's a plug for Yeshiva University. I live in Muncie, New York, and all right, 2 years ago we had the largest mumps epidemic in the history of New York. The mumps epidemic began by a Londoner coming to a Chassidish camp in the Catskills, then coming to spend the Shabbos in Muncie, and over 300 and something cases of mumps resulted therefrom. Now here, I call your attention to a scientific reality. And so happens the mumps vaccine is particularly not too good. It needs a lot of work yet. Namely, 80% of those who came down with the mumps were inoculated early in life, but obviously they now know that the mumps vaccine may have a limited lifespan. Nevertheless, the reaction of the world, the fact that over and over again, this is from the CDC, notice the language, mumps cases in New York, New Jersey, Hasidic community. Because the truth is that the Hasidic community has been particularly antagonistic to vaccinations. Why? Here we had a wonderful case that I call to your attention. I will skip that one. Okay. Why parents want to follow the rules, and we'll get back to it in a minute. Right. Some skip vaccines, etc., etc. Part of it was due to an almost dominant view in the Hasidic community that alternative medicine is better. You go into a drugstore in Muncie, you'll see more alternative medicine stuff on the shelf than anything else, especially the homeopathic medicines. As you know, the homeopathic medicines, the final product that they call homeopathic medicine, doesn't have a single molecule, it's past Avogadro's number on the dilutions, doesn't have a single molecule of the original in it. They came up with this notion of formatting water, the water picks up the power, whatever they're looking for, etc. And this is in. It seems that the Rebbes have put their stamp of approval on alternative medicine. The London religious community, the Hasidic community, on the exact same thing. There's almost no vaccination being done there, and everybody uses homeopathic medicine for preventing disease. Here we have two cases. Thanks to a little more comfortable with my notes here. like to acknowledge my receipt. I knew about the cases, but I received the legal documentation from someone who may be in our audience, lawyer Moshe Mercer Kurzman, who sent me the legal documentation from University State of New York. Here, I just put down, these are the reasons for the exemption. The state law says that if someone has a sincere religious objection, he can be exempted from inoculation. The law states that all children have been inoculated. Yeshiva Spring Valley maintained that position. They wouldn't let a child in who was not inoculated. This parent sued Yeshiva Spring Valley, demanding that the child be admitted without vaccination. And they gave the reasons why. Now remember, it has to be a sincere religious belief. Take a look quickly at the reasons that were given. Okay, yeah. It says in Genesis, God created man in his image. God is perfect, so the man has to be perfect, so you can't go ahead and claim he's not perfect by giving him inoculations. This is called a sincere religious belief when you're arguing for a non-Jewish judge. The yeshiva didn't make too great an effort because they didn't even have a lawyer, which was against the rules of the court. They had to have a lawyer, but the court allowed them. They didn't want to spend the money for it. And they ended up there. Look at their conclusion. The appeal was sustained. Order that the respondent grant a religious exemption for the immunization requirement. A second case occurred during the mumps epidemic. I didn't record it here. Similarly, the individual won the case against the Yeshiva Spring Valley by claiming sincere religious belief. If I were involved in the case, I wasn't there, I would have argued that the man should not be allowed in any shul in town, that he is surely a member of another faith, and we don't want any credit for it. Here, a quick reference to the fact that the anti-vaccination movement is well established in America and in England. And this one deserves a quick comment. The mumps, rubella, measles controversy. So, some fellow in England there, and here a second reference to it. A hoax was deliberately foisted on the world public by claiming that the mumps vaccine can cause autism. Studies were done, millions of dollars were spent to try to disprove it, and finally they found out that this man had manufactured all the data he was talking about. He was disbarred from medicine in England. He moved to America now. The mumps hoax, however, has fueled the fire against vaccination, so that to this day we're still struggling with it. And here you have a response from the medical community, and that is pediatricians who are refusing to treat, to take in on as patients, anyone who will refuse vaccination. Certainly a proper reaction. There is a new tumult in the political world because of a comment against the HPV vaccine, which Dr. Siegel will elaborate on in his presentation. I want to just conclude with one critical reference. Everybody to date has been quoting my father-in-law for everything. It's not nice I should speak without mentioning his name. Feinstein ruled a wonderful, wonderful analysis. In strange cases, the Talmud in Ksuvos Samar Daled speaks about a case where a husband has to go away for a lengthy period of time. How much money must he leave over for his wife? Or in the case of a poverty-stricken family, at what point will you force the husband to divorce his wife because he cannot support her? So the question, how much is the minimum amount you have to give for a wife? So the Talmud says you have to give 3 meals a day, etc., etc. Then it throws in a line. And also for arochin parochin, What's our working pavochen for chance guests? Our wife is home, and a guest comes in, expecting not to serve him, so she has a little extra money for a drop-in guest. Rabbi Feinstein said, children who live within the home, they are permanent guests. Hence, the ksuba that the husband signed, or the husband committed himself to, covers her financial needs, also includes the arochi porochi, which includes the children. He said, and that includes their food, their clothing, and their medical care, so that the vaccinations present a problem in a family. Since this is part of the ksuba that the husband owes the wife, it's the wife's decision how to treat her guests. Her guests, her children, are at home, and therefore she feels that they have to be given vaccination before she gets vaccinated. It cannot be she'll do something for herself and withhold it for her children, who are our permanent guests. Therefore, she makes the decision on that account. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody, and I'd like to also thank Daniel and Rachel for doing such a beautiful job in putting together this conference, and to thank Dr. Baker for a kind introduction, and reshoot all of you. It's a long day already. I'll try not to belabor too many points. I don't come here with an agenda, but I come here to try to give you again a halachic perspective on vaccination. You see here a nice picture of a young girl, compassionate elderly physician, getting a typhoid inoculation. Typhoid's not one of the things I'd like to be discussing if I'm talking about a great vaccine. So the first and most important point that I'd like to discuss is that not all vaccines were created equal. There are some excellent vaccines. There are some vaccines that are not so excellent. And there are some vaccines that are actually very poor and are only indicated in very limited situations. What I would like to focus on today is a very interesting and relatively new halachic subject, and that is forcing mandatory vaccination. And look at it from a halachic perspective. And I put up some titles here, not because I need the cover, but to tell you where I'm coming from in my background to try to tell you what there is to say about mandatory vaccination in halacha. I have a background as an infectious disease person. I have a background as a practicing rabbi, a rav of a number of different shuls, and I've worked as a chaplain in hospitals for many years. I also come with the position as being an administrator in the hospital, having to deal with the economic and health, public health concerns that mandatory vaccination raises, both for the individual patient as well as for communities. So how come we're having such a shift? There's a lot of hype about vaccinations. There's a lot of incorrect information, sometimes intentional misinformation, that is provided to people about vaccinations. And part of my role today is to clear up some of the misconceptions and misunderstandings about vaccination so that one can have an appropriate halachic discussion as to what is the Torah's viewpoint on getting a vaccination. Removing all of the hidden agendas, the ulterior motives that people may have, I have absolutely no financial stake in whether everybody in this room got vaccinated or not. I'm only interested in what the halacha has to say about vaccination. And that always asks the question, do medicine and halacha collide? Is it possible that something that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created, we just read about it a few weeks ago, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the entire Bria, Yesh Me'ayin. It is impossible for there to be anything within the world that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created that goes Kineged HaTorah. It's obvious to anybody who's a mom in the story of Bereshis. But it's clearly obviously not obvious to people that don't consider Bereshis to be a historical fact. But we, Shomer Torah Mitzvos, need to understand that it is impossible for there to be a disconnect between science and halacha. In fact, science is part of halacha. There can never be a contradiction between what Chazal tell us is halacha l'maisa and science. The only time that can happen is if the Chazal are given incorrect information. And that is something that unfortunately does occur. Halacha, psak halacha, has to be based upon empirical and investigational scientific fact. A Rav cannot paskin a shayla in a vacuum. If you ask a Rav a shayla and you don't give him all the facts, there's almost a guarantee that that Rav, no matter how brilliant he is, will come up with the wrong conclusion. The only time that doesn't happen is with a Navi. In Nebuch, we have no Naviim today. We have great Gedolei Torah. We have very reliable, Erlecha, wonderful Gedolei Torah who can paskin shaylas. But they only can paskin the shayla if they're given the correct information. And sometimes they unfortunately are not presented, either through ignorance of the people presenting it, or sometimes because they're only given part of the story. And again, without that sound understanding of all of the facts, inevitably, whether it's a halacha in business ethics, whether it's a halacha in Bishul Akum, whether it's a halacha in Shmira Shabbos, a halacha in Hilchus Refuah, mistakes will occur. And facts, in fact, do sometimes change. Halacha never changes. We spoke this morning in the plenary about smoking. There are interesting comments from great Gedolei HaPoskim who say smoking is helpful. It helps with the nerves, helps with digestion. Nobody would think for a second that those Poskim would hold that opinion halacha l'maisa today. So Posek only has the ability to paskim a shayla based upon the facts that, as they're presented to him, based upon the medical understanding. Clearly, the medical understanding in the times of the Gemara, I spoke about this in my breakout session, is quite different than the medical understanding of many halachas today. The halacha never changes. The halacha is absolute. It's the application of the halacha that can change on a regular basis. Vaccination is undoubtedly the single most effective way to prevent medical disease today. It is extremely cost-effective. Vaccines, even the very expensive ones, are measured in three-digit figures. Some of the treatments that we have can be measured in six- or seven-digit figures. Their safety has been usually very well studied, not perfect, many complications. Different vaccines have different complication rates and should be, therefore, only used as appropriately indicated. They're not perfect. They all have side effects. They all have potential, sometimes fatal, potential problems with them. But arguably, in my opinion and the opinion of many others, they're the single most important tool in a physician's armamentarium to eradicate disease. And in fact, an absolutely 100% correct fact is the only disease that has ever been eradicated because of medical intervention is the eradication of smallpox. Variola. And the proof is in the pudding. I'll give you a couple of quick background facts on smallpox. Rabbi Tender already alluded to the origins of this. I won't go into that. Smallpox is an extremely dangerous disease with a mortality of about 30% in an unvaccinated population. I engaged a few years ago in some work with the Departments of Health and many others when there was a concern that smallpox had fallen into the hands potentially of terrorist organizations or in unstable governments, and could there be a resurgence through terrorist attack of smallpox? And there were a number of studies, as well as inoculations of people to prevent against this disease that man had eradicated, but man unfortunately might bring back. But just to look at the historical note, 300 million deaths in the 20th century. We're not talking here about the 1300s. We're not talking about the Black Plague days. We're talking about modern world. In the 1900s, 300 million people died of this disease. And this disease was eradicated through HaKadosh Baruch Hu giving us the ability to create a virus, a vaccine for a virus. And the last case was in 1977, with the exception of two laboratory cases thereafter. Another success story is polio. People in this room who are about my age, if you had children who were about my age, will remember the tremendous scare that there was in communities in the middle 50s, even late 50s, until the advent of full vaccination against polio. People didn't let their children go out in the summer. They wouldn't let them congregate in camps. They wouldn't let them go to any public place because of the fear and terror that their children would get polio. Children died from polio. Rahmana Litzlan, up to 5% death from this disease. Imagine Rahmana Litzlan, a camp with 100 children. Five of them wouldn't come home at the end of the summer. We're used to five of them, or 50% of them not coming home with their underwear. But 5% wouldn't come home, Rahmana Litzlan. Adults who get polio had a higher mortality. It is highly contagious, with no known cure in 2011, never mind 1957. And prevention is the only way to combat this disease, which is still around and is still a highly fatal and debilitating disease. And it's only through universal vaccination that there are no homegrown cases in the United States anymore. And the vaccine is constantly improving, going from a live virus to an attenuated virus to an activated virus, and is an extremely highly cost-effective vaccination. And for the life of me, I cannot understand why any Shomer Torah mitzvahs, and I'll show you the halachic proof behind it, would not choose to vaccinate their children. Is vaccination a Jewish concept? It's a Torah concept. So I'll show you psukim as well as memories from Chazal. You don't have to look too far. In B'shalach it says, Kol ha-machala shasamti b'mitzrayim lo'asim alecha, ki ani Hashem rofecha. Preventative medicine, anything that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave to Mitzrayim, he, so to say, inoculated us against them, we'll never get it. In fact, that's one of the reasons by the Haggadah that we have the different Tanoim saying there were 50 Makkos, 200 Makkos, 250 Makkos. Some suggest that the more Makkos that we could have had displayed in Mitzrayim, the less there's going to be trouble for us. A concept, an idea that you can give somebody something and that people will not be able to then suffer from that disease. We have the Baruch Shomar, the Baruch Epstein, the son of the Aruch HaShulchan. He writes, we just went through the Yomim Noroim, he talks about Avinu Malkeinu. He says, what's the difference between the Avinu Malkeinu that says, Kale, Deva, Vechere, Vero, Vishvi, versus the next Avinu Malkeinu that says, Mina Magifo, Minachal Osecha. What's the difference between Kalei and Manei? He says, Kalei is after the fact. We ask Hashem to get rid of all this disease that you put on us. And the Baruch Sha'amar, over 100 years ago, says, Minei Magifa means talking about preventing it. You can only prevent a Magifa, an outbreak, an epidemic. Once it's here, it's very difficult to eradicate it. You have, again, this concept of preventing something, inoculating against something. Chazal tell us in the Midrashim, we have a chiyuv, it's brought down in Shulchan Aruch, to try to say 100 brachas a day. The Midrash tells us, goes back to earlier times, maybe to Moshe Rabbeinu, to David HaMelech, that we say 100 brachas a day to prevent plagues and infection from occurring. Concepts. I'm not saying that these are lemaisa examples, but certainly, if not a foreign concept to us, that you can have the idea that giving something to prevent an illness is a very important idea in halacha. There is not a single posek that I'm aware of that has written the classical poskim that there is anything keneged halacha against vaccination. Now, as I mentioned, not every vaccine is the same. Not every vaccine is indicated for every person. Some vaccines are far more dangerous than others, and vaccines shouldn't be used interchangeably. But when a vaccine is medically indicated, there cannot be, to my humble opinion, and I'll show you the sources for which I'm going to say this for, any halachic reason not to give the vaccine, which doesn't automatically translate to a chiyuv in halacha to give the vaccine. But there is no valid halachic opinion that says a vaccine is asur. And that's a very important idea, because as Rabbi Tendler mentioned, for somebody to argue a religious exemption against vaccination versus a personal, I don't feel like taking it, exemption, are two different things, two very important things. I do not think that there is any halachic basis to say that a vaccine is kineged the Jewish religion. A person can have a personal reason not to wish to get vaccinated. We can debate that some other time. But I'm talking from a halachic perspective. There is no posek that is put in writing amongst the major poskim that vaccination is awesome. Anti-vaccination goes back a while. It's not a modern phenomenon. The first that I could find in various internet searches was from a place in England, in Leicester, in 1885, where you had 100,000 people marching against vaccination. And they had an effigy of Jenner. This is after his innovative and life-saving work on smallpox. And amongst the anti-vaccination movement were clergy, mostly Christian clergy, who said that vaccination was kineged, quote, the halacha, was unchristian. And in the United States, in 1879, the Anti-Vaccination Society of America was already founded. So this is not Borough Park or Muncie. This is already firmly founded within the United States culture. And what, unfortunately, many of the anti-vaccination people are trying to do is fit a square peg in a round hole. And it just isn't going to go through. And let's look historically at some of the attempts to show where vaccination is dangerous. And you have the DPT, vaccine controversy of the 70s, where there was a hospital again in London where 36 children were identified as having neurological conditions after they received the DTP. A number of advocacy groups quickly formed. And then you have to look at this under the scientific rigor. And it was. In a panel at that time, and in multiple published studies since then, to show that there's not a shred of evidence to support this linkage. Showing anecdotally that something happened after something else happened, one could prove or show anything in the world. Somebody in this room will undoubtedly come down with a cold in the next week. Temporarily, it's related to the conference. Did this conference give them the cold? Maybe, maybe not. If somebody gets in pneumonia in the next week, Rahmana Litzlan. If somebody goes on a trip within the next week, did this conference cause that trip? No. Has nothing to do with each other. They're temporarily related, but they're not causally related. And an investigative study can determine, to the best of our ability, whether there's relationship that's temporal or causal. And these studies showed there was no causality between the two. Similarly, again, the MMR controversy of the late 1990s and early 2000s, and it's still going on today, where the infamous Dr. Wakefield, as was already mentioned briefly by Rabbi Tendlis, I won't go through it in detail, alleged that the MMR was improperly tested. And he published a paper in The Lancet with 12 or 13 co-authors, and boy, oh boy, did that make the news. Only problem was that it was fabricated. Ultimately, 11 of the 13 co-authors have retracted the publication. People love to get their names on publications. And most of the time, you just feel that they'll allow you to put the name on the publication, even though you haven't seen all the data, even though you haven't been involved in all of it, but you maybe contributed in some small way. Publisher perish is a very, very important principle in the academic world, and unfortunately, many people, when they put their name on a paper, aren't willing to really accept responsibility. These 11 authors were very sorry that the name was on that paper. The paper was found to be a hoax. Dr. Wakefield lost his license to practice medicine. It was shown he had a fatal conflict of interest. I put that in quotes because that's what the courts decided. He was paid for his work. And that's the end of the controversy. There is no connection that has scientifically been shown between MMR and autism. That's a fact. People don't like facts. Facts are facts. They're objective, they're clean, they're to the best of our ability. And that's the way halacha, as I also spoke in my breakout session, halacha deals with the facts as they are in the year that they're provided to the chachamim. If the facts change, the science that they're based upon is shown to be wrong, the halacha stays the same, but the application or maisa changes. Based upon the facts available today, for these vaccinations that are highly effective, extremely useful in preventing severe, fatal, debilitating diseases, to argue it is against halacha to take these vaccines is simply not halachically correct. Again, an individual person can do whatever he wants. I haven't yet gotten to the point, can halacha mandate a vaccination, which is now what I'm going to speak about. We're caught sometimes between a rock and a hard place. We all, in the scientific world, there is less mandipolit. There is no valid scientific opinion from any published journal, any medical professional society, any department of health, any CDC publication that argues against vaccination in certain conditions. Not one. This isn't a machlokus between Elu Elokim Chai and Elu. These are both valid opinions. Elu Elu Dibri Elokim Chai. This isn't even a Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, where we say that in the setting of Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai opinion doesn't count. But this is an opinion that is less man depolic. There is no scientific valid opinion today that argues with the success of these vaccinations. Not to say that there aren't people with an MD that don't disagree with it. But there is no professional organization of standing or publications that disprove what I just said from a halachic or scientific point of view. So let's talk about a subject that I think is especially important and is maybe one of the burgeoning medical ethics shilas of the upcoming years, and that is, can a government or a hospital or any organization or a yeshiva force children to be vaccinated, or in this particular case that I'll talk about, can it force healthcare workers to be vaccinated? Can I, as the president of a hospital, demand that every one of my employees be vaccinated, or I will not let them work in my hospital? So it's the revenge of the three little pigs, swine flu. Influenza is an extremely potentially dangerous disease. I won't go through the medical background, but we've had a series over the last century or so, clear major outbreaks of influenza, complications with millions and millions of people dying. It causes all sorts of severe lung damage. I won't go through any of that for this audience. What should we do about it? So somebody went to Mexico and all I got was this lousy swine flu mask. Prevention is a wonderful thing. There are lots of different ways to prevent disease. Washing your hands. I spent my career telling people to wash their hands. Arguably, the single most important way to prevent any sort of infection is washing your hands. But let's talk about swine flu specifically. We have great Gedolei HaTorah, Shlomo Amar, Shlita, Rav Yosef Shlita, who actually declared a day of fasting and prayer. This was Erev Chodesh Elul 2 years ago, because of swine flu. The evil swine flu spread from Mexico over the entire world because of our many sins. So the rabbi part of me says we all need to do tshuva to prevent epidemics. To go hand in hand. Spiritual and gashmis go hand in hand. We need to be better people. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends machalos for reasons we don't understand. I'm not a Navi, I'm not a Ben Navi. We all need to be better people. That's an extremely effective way to prevent epidemics. But that's not why I'm here today, to give a Mesilas Yishar Mishmuz. I'm here to give a practical talk. Let's look at the data. How serious is this illness of swine flu? There were millions of people in the United States in the last couple of years that got swine flu. Over 20,000 hospitalizations, with a minimum of 4,000 people, probably much higher, who died in the United States from swine flu. It's a lot of people. That's more than died in the World Trade Center tragedy. Every year, CDC estimates about 36,000 people have died from the seasonal flu, which in the past couple of years has really been swine flu, including 144 nevach, 144 children. Children aren't supposed to die from infections in the year 2011. And Rahman al-Islam, these were healthy children for the most part, not immunocompromised children necessarily. who died from a disease that is potentially preventable. 40% of these children and 20% of the adults who were hospitalized had no underlying risk factors. Healthy, Baruch Hashem, good people who one day were well and the other day had a potentially fatal illness. There is effective vaccine available. This disease isn't going away. CDC and everybody in the world with any knowledge in this area recommends vaccination against swine flu. Sounds like a no-brainer. Sounds like everybody in this room should be vaccinated. I publicly vaccinate myself every year in front of my entire staff. I was the first person in Nassau County to get vaccinated in 2009 against the swine flu. I have to show by example. I put my mouth, my money where my mouth is. Yes, there's a potential danger with any vaccine. When you're dealing with the numbers of people that died who were previously healthy versus the theoretical risk and concern of a vaccine, it's a no-brainer. People need to get vaccinated for something for which there is no essentially good treatment once you get the disease. There are some potential treatments. They're not very good, not very well tried and tested, and people die despite getting those treatments. So, can we force people? Is it a chiyuv? Are there subpopulations of people that we can mandate vaccination to? This has tremendous other halach l'maisa ramifications in terms of yeshivas closing. We know how many yeshivas won't close to go to a parade, they won't close to go to a demonstration, they won't close to do chesed, because Torah is Torah. We have to spend all our time learning if we possibly can. Well, if you don't get vaccinated and yeshiva closes for 2 weeks, as I was asked multiple times with the mumps epidemic by very right-wing yeshivos, are we going to be able to close because of this? Well, some of the yeshivas have to close because of outbreaks, so have to shut down services for a while. That also needs to be factored in if you're looking at it from a halachic point of view. The numerous Bikur Cholim issues, the Chevra Kaddish issues, Nebuch, when SARS was involved, the tremendous Chevra Kaddish issues that came up, the Minyan issues, all sorts of issues. Bottom line, it is highly medically indicated to vaccinate. Antiviral drugs are not effective 100% of the time or nowhere near it, and every CDC, DOH, everybody recommends vaccination. Yet if you look at voluntary vaccination, rates across the country revolve around the 40 to 58% area. Healthcare workers, these are doctors and nurses for a large part, who have intelligently, supposedly, chosen not to get vaccinated for reasons that are simply not scientific. There's fear, there's paranoia, there are concerns, valid concerns, but invalid science to back them up. And therefore, for example, in New York State, we became the first state in August of 2009 to mandate healthcare workers get vaccinated with swine flu. Dr. Richard Daines, who unfortunately passed away a short while ago, stated the welfare of patients is without any doubt best served by immunization. Unfortunately, many people fought this in the courts, and this was overturned just a short time afterwards. And unfortunately, it has not been brought back to the courts since then. There is adequate legal proof to show that it is not against public health, civil rights, or any sort of a violation. I won't go through the details, I'm not a lawyer, but I've discussed this with numerous experts in healthcare law. There clearly is precedent that one could argue that it is legal to mandate vaccination. What about halachically? So the Rambam has a very important idea which is codified in Shulchan Aruch, and I'll read it to you. It's very important to know that this is again brought down halacha l'maisa. Kol michshol sheyesh bo sakonis nefashos. Any stumbling block that's out there. I would classify a virus as a stumbling block. Any stumbling block that's out there that could harm a person. Mitzvah saseh lohasiro. You have a positive commandment to eradicate that stumbling block. L'hishomer mimenu. Prevent yourself from getting it. You have an obligation to take care of these needs. He adds, furthermore, in lo hasir, if you do not remove that, so then you're in trouble. If you leave these michsholos, hameviin lidei sakona, that gave you sakona, bitel mitzvah saseh, the other below sosim domim veisecha, yovin aseh, the lo saseh. Rambam quotes that in Hilchos Rotzeach, Ushmiris and Nefesh, in Perik Yud Aleph, in Sif, Dalet and Hey. It's codified in Shulchan Aruch, in Choshen Mishpat, in Hilchos Shmiris Nefesh, in Simonim Ches, Tes and Yud, in Simon Tov Chav Zayin. There it is for you. That's Halacha L'maisa. Rav Shlomo Zalman, quoted in the Nishmas Avraham, says essentially the same thing. Yisrael Lifshitz, the Tiferes Yisrael, says vaccination outweighs the slight risk and is permitted. I mentioned to you already the Shulchan Aruch. Avoiding danger is something that we normally think of, not having a pit dog, a pit bull in your house, not having an open area without a makos that you could fall off of. But there are assays, there are things that a person can do as well. The Ramah says a person has to be concerned with possible danger versus possible prohibition. And therefore the bottom line comes down. We might not be able to mandate, to absolutely say to a person that you're mechuyev to go take a vaccine. There are poskim that say that you are, there are poskim that say that you aren't. But there is absolutely an urgency to recommend, and Rav Yashiv, again from the Haredi world, Rav Yashiv is quoted, there is the citation for you, said parents should accede to immunization despite any concerns that they have. Again, this is Rav Yashiv talking. I'm not talking about a YU Rosh Yeshiva, which would be perfectly fine. But we're not talking to this Olam, we're talking to the Olam of general Klal Yisrael. And Rav Yashiv urges people to get vaccinated. And he says, refusing childhood vaccinations on the basis of unsubstantiated fears is halachically irresponsible. Halachic approach, according to Rav Yashiv, is to do what is normal. Normal is what's defined by good pediatric and adult medicine advice by the CDC. Bottom line, last slide. Hashem created the world. We're commanded to go out to Kivshuha. We have an obligation to go and investigate. We have nothing to fear from science. Should one get vaccinated? You're asking my rabbinical and medical advice. The answer is absolutely yes, even though I can't quote you chapter and verse to qualify that it's an absolute chiyuv to do so. I think personally you're over a lo sase and an ase if you don't take certain vaccinations. Not typhoid, but the major childhood xanthans for which we can prevent, and something like influenza as a healthcare worker, I think that a hospital certainly has the right, both legal, halachic, and medically, the right to say to an employee, if you don't wish to be vaccinated, you have the right not to work in this hospital. And therefore, I conclude that we should be strong advocates of saving life. It is sheker for a person to say halacha doesn't allow vaccination. That's simply not true. We can play games and argue, does halacha mandate vaccination? And we can show sources on both sides, but we have an obligation, Shmartim Otis Nafshu Seichem. We have an obligation to do everything in our power to save lives, and vaccination certainly is one of the best tools that we have for this. So I leave you with the practical advice. People are always looking for good economic advice. Put your money into hand sanitizers, because that's the other best way. Wash your hands. Thank you very much.
Okay, so it's the bottom of the ninth inning, and I see people already fiddling for their keys, just like they do at Yankee Stadium. I also want to add my thanks to Rachel and Daniel and to YU and the Medical Society, Medical Ethics Society, for inviting me, and to the Fold family for putting this all together. I am incredibly honored to be here today. I have to tell you a quick story, and my father, may rest in peace, used to say, if you have more than two Jews in a room, they want to tell a story. So I can start that. So a few months ago, I got this very nice email asking me if I would come, and of course I said yes, and then about 2 months ago, I saw who else was going to be on this panel, and I saw Rabbi Dr. Tendler's name, I saw Rabbi Dr. Glatt's name, and I heard my mother, may she rest in peace, her voice going, look what you got yourself into this time. I am truly honored. I don't know what I could possibly add to this. However, I'm going to talk about the HPV vaccine, From a pediatrician's point of view, I specialize in the healthcare for teenagers and adolescents and young adults. And a few disclosures. I am on the speakers bureau of GlaxoSmithKline and Novartis, and GlaxoSmithKline does make one of the HPV vaccines. I do not intend to discuss an unapproved or investigative use of any commercial products. And probably my most important disclosure is that I may, my guess is, I probably have a different view on sex and sexuality and sexual activity. And of course, one of the basic tenets of ethics is respect. And I certainly want to be respectful of people who don't necessarily agree with my views. But I really think it's important, if we're talking about vaccines, and particularly the HPV vaccine, to understand where different people are coming from. So I'm hoping to do that as quickly as possible. So what I'm going to do is start with a case that I have had a patient recently in our practice, talk very quickly about the background of the HPV vaccine so that we can actually have an intelligent discussion. I'm going to talk about current law, policy, and recommendations about vaccinations. I'm not a lawyer, but as I said, I'm a pediatrician, a clinician. I'm not a rabbi. I'm not a Talmudic scholar, nor will I ever be able to play one on television. But I hope we can all put what we all know and bring how we feel to the table to have a good discussion. And finally, I'm going to talk about some of the ethical considerations. Specifically, does law or the recommendations for HPV vaccine actually equate to ethical practice? Some patient considerations about informed consent and autonomy. Physician and societal considerations around beneficence and non-maleficence and concern for the public good. And finally, I'm going to finish up with what are the medical and as well as the ethical positive and negative considerations regarding the HPV vaccine. So the HPV vaccine is currently recommended for both boys and girls during adolescence. And this presents a significant challenge when we're talking about ethical considerations. It's good because the real main question up until last week was very simple. Is the HPV vaccine a good choice for your daughter, or your female patient? But what if your daughter looks like this? Is it really appropriate? And that's really what we're talking about today. And of course, as of last week, we now have a new recommendation. What about your son? And once again, what if your son looks like this? Is this really an appropriate discussion to have? Is it really an appropriate question to ask? Well, the truth is, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm sure I don't have to convince you, that no matter what parents' beliefs are, adolescents, and yes, even young adults, don't necessarily do everything they're supposed to do. I would love to say that adults do the thing that we all should be doing. But we all know that there are adolescents that don't necessarily behave in the way that we want them to do. And I'm keeping my son and daughter out of this discussion, by the way. Okay, so let's talk about a case scenario. This is a patient that came to me recently. Her name was JG. She's 15 years old. She came to the United States just 2 weeks prior. She came for the summer. She was here on vacation. She came to our adolescent medicine program. She was accompanied by her maternal aunt, and she was brought in for a routine checkup, just preventive healthcare visit. She had no complaints. Her past medical history was unremarkable. She takes no medications, no allergies, no surgeries, hospitalizations. The kind of patient you can't make a living off of. She was completely healthy, thank God. As I talked to her, I found out that her social history, she actually was sexually active, even at 15. She used absolutely no form of contraception. She had 4 male partners. She's been treated twice for gonorrhea, 3 times for chlamydia. Her last menstrual period was 2 weeks before I saw her. She'd never been pregnant, thank God, and denied use of alcohol, tobacco, or drugs. Now, if you look at the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendations, the CDC recommendations, the American Academy of Family Practice recommendations, as Rabbi Dr. Tendler spoke about, there's a lot of vaccines that she might need. But at 15, I focused in on this. the quadrivalent HPV vaccine. The vaccine that she had not gotten was against human papillomavirus. And given her history of sexual activity, in fact, sexual promiscuity, this is something I was very worried about. We know from national samples in high school students, now this is public high school students all over the country, I'm sorry, something happened with my slide, but 46% of all adolescents in public high schools across the country have had sex. Now, we're not going to solve that problem today. I would love it if I could change that. But that led and has led to the recommendation that adolescent boys and adolescent girls get their HPV vaccines between 11 and 12. Because, unfortunately, the data, again, from public schools shows that these kids are having sex. So what is human papillomavirus? Human papillomavirus is the most common sexually transmitted infection in the United States, and it accounts for about 12,000 adult women with cervical cancer. Almost 4,000 women, unfortunately, die from cervical cancer every year. About 1% of all sexually active adults in the United States, or about 1 million people, at any particular time have genital warts. It's commonly spread through sexual contact, and often patients have no symptoms. There are 40 different types of HPV, and many, as I said, cause cervical cancer. Now, HPV vaccine works by preventing the most common types of HPV, human papillomavirus, and according to the CDC data, these vaccines could stem the tide against cervical cancer in the United States and elsewhere. There are currently two different types of HPV vaccine. The trade names are Gardasil and Cervarix. And I apologize. And again, this is not a vaccine against sexually transmitted infections, but it is targeting cervical cancer. So here's the ethical issue that I was faced. Should the HPV vaccine be given to JG at 15 years of age? And can it be given without parental consent? Because her mother, who is her caretaker, was not present. Remember, she came in with her maternal aunt. And if I couldn't give it to her, because the mother was not there, could I give her the HPV vaccine? Could I offer it to her? And if she wanted it, could I give it to her based on something in New York State called the mature minor doctrine? Now, very quickly, what is a minor in New York State? In New York State, we say anyone under the age of 18 is a minor. This comes from a British law, English law, that says children are the properties of their parents. So therefore, anyone under the age of 18, you must have consent from a parent to give any vaccine. A minor is denied certain rights under the law. So a minor can't vote, can't run for an office. A minor, however, is entitled under the law to some additional protection. As you heard earlier, financial protection. There is a legal statute that says you must provide food and shelter and education to a minor. Well, under New York State law, there are certain exceptions to this law. So a minor, for example, who understands the risks and benefits of a proposed or an alternative treatment can consent if the issues are related to reproductive health care. So, for example, family planning, emergency contraception, abortion, pregnancy or prenatal care, care during labor and delivery, and care and treatment for a sexually transmitted infection. Additional protections are also for mental health issues under some circumstances, some alcohol and drug abuse services, and sexual assault treatment. So the statute in New York State basically is trying to protect those adolescents who, if they didn't seek treatment because they wouldn't tell their parent for fear, they would never get treatment at all. So there are many Supreme Court decisions in the United States that have set the stage here. In 1970, a 17-year-old girl in Kansas, the Supreme Court said, yes, a doctor can treat her broken finger without parental consent. In 1972, a 16-year-old boy in Pennsylvania, this case went up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, because he wanted surgery, and the Supreme Court ruled in his favor over the mother's religious objections. And in 1982, a 17-year-old girl with chronic back pain, the Supreme Court said, could consent. Other reproductive health care issues in New York State, I mentioned pregnant minors, minors who are parents, they've already delivered a child, even though they're under 18, minors who are legally married, and emancipated minors. So the mature minor doctrine in New York State basically says that if in the healthcare provider's judgment, the minor, that is someone under the age of 18, is emotionally and intellectually mature enough to understand the ramifications of the treatment or the proposed treatment, give informed consent, even though they're living under the supervision of a parent, they may be allowed to make healthcare decisions, again, even without parental consent. New York Public Health Law 2305 does permit minors to consent for treatment of a sexually transmitted infection. HPV, I would argue, and many people would argue, is a sexually transmitted infection. We said it's the most common sexually transmitted infection in the United States. And the vaccine, some would argue, is a treatment prior to the presence of a disease. Rabbi Dr. Glatz said, wait a minute, you know, prevention isn't the same as treatment. Well, you know, we would hold the same. But treatment, I might argue, could be active, that is, you have a disease, and I give you a medication to make you better, causal, or in the case of the HPV vaccine, preventive. So that could be viewed and argued as a preventive treatment. The commissioner of the Department of Health is given legal responsibility in New York State to list all of the sexually transmitted infections that he or she deems appropriate. And one of those includes anogenital warts, which is included in the 2000 list. And many medical organizations like the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Society for Adolescent Health and Medicine, urge providers to take every opportunity to give as much as we can, specifically when it comes to immunizations, and if the decision-making capacity is there in that adolescent, because we know something about adolescents, they don't go to doctors. And when they do come to doctors, it's often episodic care. So we want to do as much in one visit as possible. So one reason cited is to avoid the risk that a minor will not receive the care that he or she needs because they are afraid of involving their parent. So let's go to some common ethics principles in medicine that we talk about. Autonomy, which is the right to choose, the right for me to decide what's going to happen to my own body. Non-maleficence, that is, first do no harm. What are the risks of anything that we do? Beneficence, to advance the health of others and to protect people. Justice, that is a standard for the allocation of resources so that everybody achieves the same benefit. Clearly, dignity and sacredness of human life. Truth-telling and common good. So truth-telling meaning that with my patient, should I have to tell her that this exists, but I can't give it to her because her mother isn't here? Well, in this case, informed consent is where a patient voluntarily agrees to the proposed treatment. That is, she or he must have the capacity to understand what is happening to his or her body, his or her condition, the nature and the purpose of the proposed treatment or the alternative treatments, and the risks versus the benefits. That's autonomy. The HPV vaccine to fight cervical cancer, we could argue, is beneficence. It's beneficial to people who get it, right? Theoretically, at least. And there's good data from the scientific literature to say that this would keep this young girl from getting cervical cancer, or at least decrease her risk. What about non-maleficence? I mentioned the risk factors. Well, we know that both the Cervarix and the Gardasil, the two HPV vaccines, have similar risks. just like any injection, you can get pain or redness, maybe a fever, headache or fatigue, nausea, vomiting, muscle or joint pains, and fainting, which is very common with adolescents. So from a non-maleficent standpoint, the two HPV vaccines are similar. And what about the public good? Well, clearly, the government's interest is in maintaining and improving the health of our population. And the legislators' intent was to encourage minors to have access to health care, and specifically to make sure that they get confidential health care if they can't involve their parents. And the New York public health policy supports providing adolescents with unimpeded access to health care, specifically when it relates to sexual reproductive health. So the immunization issue here, this is again a 15-year-old, she's a minor, she may not give informed consent on her own based on her age. Minors do require parental approval prior to obtaining a treatment. We don't know if her mother would agree or object, and we have a designated relative standing here, and I just didn't know what to do. So in summary, I was having a bad day. I've got a girl who's 15 years old, who's sexually promiscuous, she's had multiple sexually transmitted infections in the past. I thought she was very mature. But really, if I thought she was mature, that would mean that her consent was all that would be necessary for me to get off the hook and give her HPV vaccine. Unfortunately, her maternal aunt, who was obviously much smarter than I was, looked at me and said, "Oh, by the way, if you're talking about that HPV vaccine, I don't want her to get it." So I certainly could not give her the HPV vaccine because she voiced that objection. So in summary, more education is clearly needed for parents, as well as adolescents and young adults, about the fact that there is an HPV vaccine out there. Most adolescents don't know it exists. Most parents don't know that it exists, and often they have no idea about the risks and the benefit profile. We need, as healthcare providers, to, from an ethical framework, make sure that they are informed so that they're, in fact, making an informed decision. All adolescents, I believe, should be offered the HPV vaccine at that 11 to 12 visit with parental consent, because education, I hope, would be going along with it. However, as has been touched on by previous speakers, we have some issues. Parents are afraid that this is a sexually transmitted infection, and therefore the vaccine will increase sexual promiscuity. Or is this just a vaccine hoax? Is this all about selling more vaccine? Is it more about money than it is about health? People are worried about the erosion of parental rights, as I am, that parents should be involved in their healthcare decisions of their children. This unsafe safety, well, I have to be honest with you, and I know I have a skewed view as a pediatrician and as someone who believes in vaccines, as Rabbi Dr. Tendler and Rabbi Dr. Blatt said, this does save lives, and I do believe this is the most important thing I can do in the young years to help improve women's health care many years down the road. But certainly, this should not be a mandatory vaccine, because there are no data to suggest that mandating this would increase beneficence, decrease maleficence, or increase autonomy. And again, from an ethical framework, what we really need to do is education, education, and education. And Governor Rick Perry, who I was amazed, you know, comes a conservative governor from a very conservative state, wants a mandate HPV vaccine. Well, it was very quickly found out by all of us that he was on the take. He was being paid by Merck, who made the first vaccine. I'm not surprised people have a bad taste in their mouth. And then, of course, Michelle Bachmann, who says, I spoke to somebody who told me that the HPV makes you mentally retarded. I'll leave it at that. There is a lot of misinformation, but we, as ethicists, as medical professionals, as helping professionals, really need to get the word out. So in closing, decisions about the HPV vaccine must be made in this context, knowing that there is organized opposition to childhood vaccines in general, knowing that there are allegations that the risks are being downplayed and there's general mistrust of the drug manufacturers as well as healthcare providers. There's disagreement of what to do with that adolescent who is not following what you believe they should be following, and child rearing practices and inaccurate information on the internet. Most of my patients have already done a Google search before they come to see me. They've already decided if they're going to trust me based on what's on the internet. Well, unfortunately, they're also doing the same thing with vaccines because they can Google what they're going to get the first time they see me. So transparent policies obviously have to acknowledge these disagreements and the uncertainties about the HPV vaccine so that we can build trust in the medical community and throughout the country and support for not only HPV vaccine but vaccines in general, because in the end what we're looking for is to create healthier adolescents and young adults. So once again, I want to thank you for inviting me and thank you for your attention.
For a few questions, I believe. Is that correct? Yeah?
Ramifications of the vaccine are almost identical to what I outlined in my talk. It would certainly be permissible for a parent to give the vaccine. It certainly is not a chiyuv in any way. This would be one of those vaccines that I would be far less supportive of as making a strong campaign and push within the community, but I think that would depend on the community. I think in communities where, unfortunately, the risk of HPV disease is significant, then parents who do not vaccinate their child are unfortunately probably not doing the right thing by their child. Now, that's not condoning or in any way saying halachically it's acceptable to do that in terms of the practices that the child may be doing. However, if a person is doing something risky in halacha, halacha recommends that you minimize the risk as much as possible. It doesn't sanction doing something that's keneged halacha, but if somebody is doing something that is keneged halacha, halacha would say at least minimize your isurim as well as the complications of those isur. I've asked the shayla to a number of poskim, and that general framework is the response I got in regards to, for example, can a person use protection to prevent against getting a sexually transmitted disease, even though the act of bia, the act of relations that they're doing is also, we're talking about a situation where the act is also. So we're not condoning the act, we're not recommending that the act be done, the act is an issa. Given the fact that the person is doing the issa, the question is, what does halacha allow you to do? And there are poskim that would say in that situation, you could give the vaccine.
I think there's another point that should be made. Baruch Hashem, our children don't have to worry about premarital sex, at least so we hope. But there is a country that we live in under severe financial stress. Part of the stress is that I think now some 17% of our budget of the gross national product goes from health care. HPV prevents cervical cancer. Cervical cancer is a major drain on the expense that's available. We have a problem of justice, namely equal distribution, equal allocation of scarce resources. I would think that the Jewish community, under the previously discussed concept of the need of the world, or the light of the world, as the conference is calling it, the light to the world, would be to actively support an HPV program so as to reduce the end medical expense of non-vaccinated.
Go ahead, yeah. Rabbi Falk, please.
I'm not going to get a HPV vaccine that I want to speak of, and will promote group security. I think that's a question that our community needs to deal with. And that's really a cost of benefit, not a financial benefit. Will our kids react that this is coming to the head of the safety? Leave that aside. Rabbi Brad, I want to suggest that I don't agree with you about vaccination. It's not the issue. Mothers are not vaccinated children to bring your home. And I use the solution to promote that they have my community. For example, there's a big chicken punch. That's a variety. When I have two primary children, two animals, primary children mean that they're, as you know, the home, the audience understands, very, very compromised. And my name is Steve Farber, and the chicken punch all over them. When you register me, I ask them to send a message to the doctor that if those kids got sick, she had to be physically hurt. I don't need her money, but she's a runner, she's a runner. Those are a lot of confrontations. A runner gives chicken pox, can kill people who are immune compromised with AIDS and transplantation, it takes down people with chemotherapy. I don't agree with the parents' obligation to prevent their children from doing damage in the field. It's my dear health officer, the English is around me, and there should be clear about the punishment where it's intended to be established.
For those that may not be able to hear, the question was really whether it's clear, als being gerodet, and this question has been posed to the great Gedolei HaPoskim, and many of them have not been willing to make the statement that you just made. I personally do tell people that I do think it's a chiyuv. I quote the Rambam and Shulchan Aruch to say the same things that you just said. However, in halacha one has to be fair and one has to be accurate and not come in with an agenda. And this question has been asked to many great poskim, including Rashi Yeshiva here at Yeshiva University, as well as to other Rashi Yeshiva, and many have not been willing to go on the record to say that there is an absolute chiyuv to do some of those vaccinations. Again, even Rav Eliashiv, who I pointed out to you, feels it's a strong urging to do so, was specifically asked this question on my request through somebody and was not willing to come out with a statement that is a chiyuv to do so. I personally agree with you. I personally think that there is adequate support from Shulchan Aruch, Rambam, and others to suggest that it could be considered a chiyuv, but the great poskim are far greater than me. I'm not a posek. Disagree with both you and me. Having said that, I strongly stand by what I said, that even if it's not an absolute chiyuv, I think that there is an obligation to encourage and urge people, which I try to do, and I know many others try to do, to say that this is a very good thing. But to fall into the class of the rodev, unfortunately, or fortunately, that's not the psak of many great poskim.
Thank you for that great question, because that is the vast majority of the kids I see. To be provocative, I use JG for obvious reasons. But no, I do believe that she should take the HPV vaccine because, again, she may not ever have sex with anyone other than her husband or her future husband, but we don't know what he has done in the past. And I do believe that this is an opportunity to decrease or at least minimize her risk of cervical cancer in the future. So yes, I do offer it to all of my patients. And as of last week, the recommendation has changed, and now we are supposed to be offering to the boys as well as the girls. Up until last week, it was much more difficult. I was supposed to talk about this to the girls, but not to the boys. And now it's the CDC made it much easier for me.
Please. I think that concludes this session. We're now going to have our concluding remarks. I want to thank our panel for an enormous, enlightening session. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dean Bacon, Rabbi Dr. Tendler, Rabbi Dr. Glatt, and Dr. Siegel. We would like to thank you all for coming today to participate in the 6th Annual Medical Ethics Society Conference on Public Health. Today we have heard from legal, medical, and halachic experts about contemporary public health issues that have a profound effect on our communities. This only begins the conversation about these vital issues. It is important for us to realize the prevalence and significance of these matters and continue to work together towards establishing healthier communities.
Once again, this conference would not have been possible without the hard work and tireless efforts of all the staff and students involved in putting together today's program. We thank you once again all for coming, and have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you, good evening.